Matt.
The meeting has been called order.
Ms. Doyle, will you please call the roll? Ms. Doyle's not here.
Ms. Doyle's not here, so I'll fill in. Trustee Athens?
Here.
Trustee Barsima?
Here.
Trustee Butler? Trustee Herrero? Trustee Ennis?
Here.
Trustee Strom?
Here.
Trustee Wasowitz? Board Chair Gales?
Here. Ms. Superior, will you please confirm that the appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. You have your quorum present. An appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So made, Strom.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries. Now may I have a motion to amend that motion in order to approve a consent agenda as follows. Action items 7A through 7B.
So made, Strom.
Is there a second? Any discussion again? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of the regular meeting of the Board of Trustees on September 25th, 2025? Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. I want to welcome the University Advisory Committee representatives present today. Do any of you have any comments?
I don't, but my mic's not working.
All right, thank you, thank you. Oh, just to give a couple little comments. First of all, good morning, still good morning. Wanted to say if any of you know me, you know that this is my favorite season. I love the Thanksgiving and the Christmas holidays. I couldn't help as I was driving up here, but being thankful for many of the things that really are in life today. And let's just say, you know that I always talk about what's going on in America today and some of the problems that we face, but we're kind of isolated here because we're Huskies, right? We're Huskies, we lean on one another, we support our students top notch, but I couldn't help but think, some 40 some odd years ago, I was a student on this campus, and I was a first generation student on this campus. And I was looking at some materials in preparation for today's meeting, and it struck me that we really haven't lost our flavor as it relates to first-gen kids. We are still 50-some-odd percent first-gen. And I sat back and I said, you know, Milton and Pearl Gales would be so proud of where we are today, the Gales family. I'm a first-generation college kid. I've produced three daughters. And all three of my daughters, as of next month, will be college grads. That's something to say about Huskies, because if not for Northern Illinois University, that wouldn't be the case. Northern has opened the door for people like me, and hopefully will do that for decades to come. Let's be thankful. But I also wanted to take a moment, too, to thank the folks that oftentimes don't get thanked, and that's the staff that support us as a board. Without you all preparing us for these meetings, educating us as to what's going on the campus, we would be ineffective. So I wanted to say thank you during a time of thanks for our season. Thank you. I also wanted to say thank you to the board, because the board, many of you probably know this, we don't get paid. This is all volunteer. They do this because of their love for the university. And they're not only just the physical structures of the university, or the professors, the teachers, it's the love of students and the knowledge that what we do in this room, what happens when we leave this campus and we turn this strictly over to the president and her staff, it's about being student-centric, being focused on the development of students. These are our future leaders of tomorrow. One day, these same students that are gracing our hallways, that are sitting here at the tables with us, will be guiding this university. And I want to be thankful for that as well. So with that said, let's move on with our program. We realize members of the public, recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our parliamentarian. Mr. Perry, have we received any timely request to address this meeting?
Mr. Chair, no public comment this afternoon.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. We will now move to the President's Report, number 191. President Freeman, will you please present the report?
Thank you, Chair Gales. And before I do, I just want to make sure we're all thankfully recognizing that Trustees Wasowitz and Trustees Butler have joined us again.
Thank you.
The following items have been moved to the consent agenda. Agenda item 7A, fiscal year 2027 appropriations request, and agenda item 7B, fiscal year 2027 IBHE capital budget request.
May I have a motion to approve the consent agenda as read by President Freeman?
So made, Strum.
Second.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries.
Thank you. It's now my pleasure to present agenda item 7C, a presentation by President Dan Mahoney of the Southern Illinois System on the intercollegiate athletics landscape. President Mahoney, in addition to the role that we know him in, is a scholar of sports management. Vice President Frazier and I have heard from our counterparts at other MAC institutions about how useful it was to them to have President Mahoney present to their boards and university communities. And we were very eager to have him come and present to NIU. The schedules aligned so that this board meeting presented a wonderful opportunity from a time standpoint for him to join us. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to him to talk about intercollegiate athletics, past, present, and future. President Mahoney.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, President Freeman. And this is my area of interest, so I'm always excited to talk about this. And I will say, if you want to interrupt me at any time and ask questions, I'm happy to take them as we go along. I always feel like I need to start with my own personal background relative to college athletics. I was not a college athlete, but I am a fan and have been my entire life. I chose to study this. I still teach a class on intercollegiate athletics because I like it so much. And my father was a college athlete, and that is why he met my mom. So without college athletics, I would not be on this earth today. I need to say that all that because sometimes it will sound like I'm quite critical of college athletics, but it's not coming from a place of hate. It's actually coming from a place of love. If we go to the next slide, what I'll talk a little bit about is the past, and I think sometimes, and some of this is the recent past, but sometimes there's a misunderstanding, particularly when we look at the governance of athletics and higher education, and even historically how it started. I think a lot of us think that somehow at some point in college history that a group of really smart people sat down and said, we want to have college athletics. We want to develop this model based on these values with these goals in mind, and they came up with this really well thought out model. And so we often talk about college athletics as it is it was meant to be this way, almost as if someone decided that. That is complete fiction. That is not at all what happened, not even remotely close. College athletics actually started by students creating these programs in direct opposition to the faculty and often the administrators at those universities, who frequently tried to ban the activity because they did not agree with it at all. So it was not actually something well supported. In fact, at Harvard, the traditional game, football game between the freshmen and the sophomores was referred to as Bloody Monday because of the brutality of the game, but also because it was played on Monday, which was the same day as the faculty meeting was, so no one could actually catch them playing football. So it gives you some sense of where this started. So the model really more evolved than was created thoughtfully at different points. At some point, the students decided they couldn't do this on their own, so they asked some graduates to come back and help advise them. And I always describe it to my students as, you remember when you asked your mom to help you with that science project and she eventually did it for you? That's kind of what happened to the students. The graduates came back, really became the coaches, eventually athletic directors, and took over, really more control over it. The presidents occasionally got involved. The creation of the NCAA in 1905 was really led by a group of presidents at that time who were really deciding between, once again, banning it completely or finding a model that they could live with. And they decided on the latter. And a lot of that was related to a number of concerns, including about 20 deaths in college football that occurred in that particular season. So they moved forward with it, but the NCAA as a organization was relatively weak for most of its history. They did not actually even penalize a school for violating its rules until the 1950s. So for the first 50 rules, the rules were more suggestions than actually something you had to follow. We recently heard Charlie Baker speak at a conference that President Freeman and I were at, and he was talking about the new governance model in college athletics, and he basically said, you know, it's always been this way. Well, if you mean by since I was in my 30s, it's always been this way, that's true. It's not always been this way. For most of the NCAA history, it was a one university, one vote model. So the Power Four schools had no more power than a Division III program had in its voting, and it was largely the ADs who were really in charge of college athletics, those with the most expertise. The presidents decided this was becoming something they needed more control over and kind of successfully pushed for another model in the 1990s, and that's what we've had since then. I will say there's pros and cons to that. I say, you know, when you think about presidents and the path we go through, much like President Freeman and myself, you know, we start as faculty, we kind of learn a lot about the academic side, we eventually get into the finance side, the marketing, student recruitment, we learn about fundraising, all of those things, but we learn almost nothing about college athletics. So I always say it's the equivalent of someone starting at General Motors at the bottom and moving their way up, and all of a sudden, oh yeah, by the way, you have to run the Detroit Lions too. It's kind of an entirely different enterprise that we're thrown into as presidents, and I will say, having been involved for the last 10 plus years as a president, the number of time I've seen presidents and chancellors who clearly don't understand certain aspects of college athletics, and I understand that they weren't really trained in that, they kind of got thrown into it. So they sometimes, the athletic directors are in a much better position, I think, to understand it, but the presidents are the ones who are pretty much in control. And I think one of the things that many presidents think as they come in is that the economic model in college sports makes sense, that this was developed by people who looked at all those decisions, looked at return on investments, decided this coach's contract or this facility was going to pay off in the long term. And I say the first thing they need to learn is that is not true. It makes no rational economic sense. You cannot justify it in any way except for the fact that we do what everybody else does. We pay what we pay, we do what we do because we're trying to keep up with every other institution. I always remember there was a quote by Jerry Reinsdorf when they went to arbitration in baseball when he said, oh great, now I have to pay as much as my stupidest competitor. That has been the economic model of college athletics, is we kind of follow whoever is further out there and doing some things. I will say that's not unusual in sports. We do this across sports. We're rarely rational when it comes to sports in the United States. We were just talking about youth sports. My daughter played AAU basketball, and the number of people who played with her would say, you know, all this investment we're putting into AAU is going to pay off because you're going to get that full ride scholarship to college. And my wife and I would look at them and say, well, you're shorter than we are. There's a pretty good chance she's not going to get a full ride basketball scholarship. You'd be better off putting your money into a 529 plan. But no one thought that that was the rational decision. They thought investing in AAU was the better decision. And my daughter did not play college basketball, even with our height advantage. Now, when I look at past profitability, and what I really looked at is both the combination of what the NCAA puts out and through FOIA requests, I know what basically the public universities have. And the data tends to align very well and aligns with what I know about my own institutions. And one of the things that the NCAA looks at closely is what's called net generated revenue. Net generated revenue looks at the revenue the athletic department actually generates. So not all the revenue on their balance sheet, sometimes, or income statement, some of the things like institutional support, government support, student fees are not considered generated revenue. That's revenue given to athletics to help support it, but it's not revenue they're actually generated. And so what the NCAA looks at to kind of look at profitability is what's your net generated revenue, which is generated revenue minus your expenses. That's your net generated revenue. So when I talk about these numbers, I'm referring to net generated revenue, and again, that's the NCAA's definition, not necessarily even mine. What I can say when you look at the last few years, and I looked at really particularly fiscal year 22 through 24, is it's never made economic sense, and it has gotten considerably worse over those 3 years. All of this is pre-house. All of this is before the things that I'll get to in just a bit. So if you look at the Power Four conferences, the ones we think about being profitable, the reality is most of them aren't. Generally, there's only about 25 schools in the country that at least break even or have more generated revenue than expenses. And that's been pretty consistent for a while, but the losses have tended to accumulate. So if you look at the Power Four, in fiscal year 22, the average loss was about $2 million. So a relatively small amount, so you get pretty close to break even. By fiscal year 24, the average loss in the Power Four was $14 million. It had escalated $12 million. Again, all pre-house, they have lost more money in the last few years than they were losing before that. And there really is no conference where the mean is above zero. So even the SEC and Big Ten schools have means now that are below zero. The SEC is the only one with a median slightly above zero. So most of them, again, are losing money. When we go to the group of five, which you're part of, which is that second level of FBS school, the average loss there is $28 million. On top of that, what is, I think, most interesting is the more you make, the more you lose. And let me repeat that. The more you make, the more you lose. So the more generated revenue an institution has, the higher their losses are, which seems to fly in the face of what you would think mathematically would normally happen. What that means is, essentially, if we're making an extra dollar, we're spending an extra $1.25. So we're never growing our way out by growing revenue, which has been the big talk. If you read what I read every day, the D1 ticker, everything's talking about, well, we just need to grow our way out of it through growing revenue. At least historically, that has not worked at all. So there's, again, and the same thing is true in the FCS level. So almost the exact same phenomenon happens where the more you make, the more you lose. The average loss at the FCS level is about $16 million. Their generated revenue on average is about $6 million at the power, the group of five, excuse me, the generated revenue is more, about $20 million, but they lose about, again, $28 million. Now, I should say that's the average. There are schools within there that are different. And if I look at NIU, and I have, you fall pretty well into what the FCS schools look at from a loss standpoint. You're losing a lot less than most of the group of five schools are when you look at net generated revenue. So there is variation within each of those groups. But again, at the FCS level, if you look at the top quartile, they generate about $10 million, but they lose $32 million. The bottom quartile only generates $4 million, but only loses $10 million. So it gives you that, and that kind of goes across all the four quartiles. Same thing is true with Division I with no football, and what I think is most interesting is the average loss is still $16 million. So as much as football is our most expensive sport, and you would think that their losses would be less without football, they're not. They average almost exactly the same. Within a million, they're just slightly off. But the same phenomenon happens again. The more they make, the more they lose. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's great information. Thank you very much. So what is going into the expense side? Mm-hmm. Is it scholarship? Is it salaries? Facility? I mean, what makes up the expense side?
All of those things, yeah. So scholarships, salaries, facilities are usually your biggest one. Travel is a big one, some of which has escalated, certainly. I think even if you look at the Power Four conferences, as the Big Ten expanded from California to New Jersey, that's going to escalate your travel costs as well. So all of those things that are costs related to that. Now, I should say we're relying on institution reporting. It is possible that some of them are slightly different in how they might report, say, the electricity costs in your Coliseum or something like that. Some may have that buried within the institution. Some may be reporting it as part of the athletic department expenditures. But even with those variances, it's not, most of the institutions look fairly similar at similar levels. So anyways, with Division One with no football, again, that's interesting. You would think that they wouldn't lose as much. The only explanation I have is they invest then a lot more in the other sports, particularly basketball. And I was at one of those schools, Winthrop, that didn't have football, that way overspent on basketball because we didn't have football. So again, you see that same type of phenomenon. As you go down to the Division II level, with football, the average loss is about $7 million. Without football, $6 million. Division III level, $3.8 million. With football and 2.3 without. I should point out, though, even at that level, some of them, for example, Division II without football, the largest loss is $29 million. So some of them are spending at the same level as a Division I program, even at the Division II level. So again, there's variances within those groups. Now, whenever I talk about this with any group, the question is, well, what about the benefits? Yeah, there's benefits beyond the income statement of the athletic department. And there's two ways of looking at it. One is there a benefit of winning? And I will say, from a researcher standpoint, that's easier to look at, because I can look at a year you won versus a year you didn't win, and see what the changes that occurred, say, in enrollment or fundraising or any of those things. What I'll get to later is what's hard to measure is, well, what if you all decided just to get rid of athletics completely? What would be the financial impact? That I can't do because nobody's really done that. So there's no real, there's not even one example well enough a group to really look at. But let's look at those things and the benefits of winning. I think one of the ones that's talked about a lot is the benefits on enrollment. This was the famous Flutie effect. And I'm hoping that most of you are old enough to remember Doug Flutie and the famous pass. And what was written about quite a bit after that was applications to institutions went up 25%. And they called that the Flutie effect. And everybody in the country said, we got to chase that Flutie effect. I mean, if you can get a 25% increase in applications, that's worth it. I will say there's two problems with the Flutie effect. There is a massive difference between applications and enrollment. And what we see is an impact on applications, not necessarily an impact on enrollment. In fact, one of the examples I had a person I knew, donor, when I was at my previous institution, used to talk about his brother worked at Auburn. And he told me over and over again that when Cam Newton won the Heisman and they won the national championship, every dean was so excited because they hit all their enrollment goals, exceeded it. It was the greatest year enrollment Auburn ever had. I heard this story so many times, I'm like, I'm just going to look it up. Want to guess how much Auburn went up in enrollment that year? It's a trick question because they didn't. They actually were down one student. It was essentially flat. It had no impact on their enrollment whatsoever. But someone kept telling me the story over and over again about how it just had blown their enrollment up, even though there was no real impact. I used to also see this when I was at Winthrop, because Clemson was winning national championships, which would escalate their applications. And then on May 1st, when those people didn't come, they would go to their wait list and steal all of my students, which I really did not appreciate. So that was, you know, they could hit their enrollment numbers at Clemson, but they had to go to their wait list because those students applied but didn't necessarily come. The other thing is on fundraising, and they've done studies back to the 1930s and cannot find any real relationship between winning and general fundraising to the institution. It just doesn't necessarily have that impact. And there's even some concern, I think, particularly right now, that the fundraising we're doing for athletics and for NIL and other things will actually detract from our ability to raise money for other parts of the institution. And there has been some research, although I will say on an isolated case, where that has happened before. The last thing is media attention. So we made the NCAA tournament at SIUE last year, and so everybody goes through that whole thing of calculating, you know, what's the value of the media attention you get, and you absolutely get an increase in media attention. I will say the problem is that media attention is only good if it leads to something that is of value to me. I always say Coca-Cola is not advertising just so you know Coca-Cola, they're advertising so you buy Coca-Cola. So if the media attention does not lead to increases in enrollment, increases in fundraising, or some other increase, then I have questions about what value it really has to the institution, as much as we talk about that. And again, when I was at Winthrop, that was one of the things my board frequently told me is how basketball success was driving the university's enrollment and its success. And so after years, again, I'm a data guy, I did the analysis, and over 20 years, there was absolutely no impact on how well we did in basketball on either our enrollment or our fundraising success. They were totally unrelated things. And actually, sometimes success can be costly. The one I'll talk about often is bowl games. Sometimes you're better off not making a bowl game than making a bowl game if you look at it purely from a fiscal standpoint, because the cost for most schools exceeds what they actually get in payouts. What I can't measure is the impact of just having it. Athletics is a social event that brings together large groups of the university community, the larger community, in ways we can't do in any other way. And there's certainly some positivity that comes from all of that that I can't actually measure, because no one's getting rid of their athletic department, so we all have it to some extent. I also can't measure, I'm an Ohio State doctoral degree from Ohio State, don't hold that against me, but Ohio State's football has always been great. And there's certainly a benefit to Ohio State from an enrollment and fundraising standpoint, the fact that they've had a consistently great, at the top of the country program for years, I can't measure what that is because they've never not been Ohio State in football. They've never gone through a period long enough to see what would happen if they were all of a sudden a bottom of the Big Ten school. I don't know what that is. So there are many things I can't measure because I can't compare them to anything else. So there's a lot of that I think is beneficial. I'm a true believer that some of the things that we were able to do at SIUE last year with the basketball run, bringing the community in ways we had never really done before, were beneficial. It's just very hard to measure, and it's hard to tell exactly what that is. Yeah.
Because one of the things you hear, and it's probably like the Auburn thing, mm-hmm. is like a successful football program really covers the cost of the other sports. So when are you aggregating them when you're putting them together?
When I'm talking about the financial side, yes. So okay. When I'm talking about, for example, the Power Four schools losing on average $14 million, that's mm-hmm. taking all of that revenue for football and basketball, including that into that model, mm-hmm. and after they cover the cost of those other sports, which is absolutely true, what you're saying is definitely true for schools like that, mm-hmm. it actually still loses money overall.
Okay.
What I would say is that I think what is misunderstood a lot is that that's true for those schools, but not for most schools. Okay. So, you know, when I was at Winthrop again, I got into our own data there. Our biggest money loser was basketball by far. Mm-hmm. So the greatest negative financial impact, if you look just at athletics. Now, again, was there other benefits in the way it brings the community together? It was a great activity for students, all of that, yes. But when I look at it purely from a financial standpoint, we lost more in basketball than any other sport.
Thank you.
We did not. That was a discussion when I first got there. So I commissioned a study by a group of economists to come up with a conclusion I knew that we would come up with from the beginning, which was that would be a very, very stupid decision for us to start football. The upfront costs of starting a program from scratch are just enormous. And I will say, I think at the time I started there, like our excess reserve was maybe about $23,000. So I didn't quite have the $20 million I needed to invest to start a football program. I barely had enough to hire one staff person. So it just didn't make any rational sense. But no, they didn't. So basketball became our premier sport, and that's where we invested more into it.
I was just going to make a comment. I think I agree with your Flutie theory, because I think I remember, maybe somebody will prove me wrong, but when we went to the Orange Bowl, mm-hmm. I mean, that was our Flutie moment, right, when we went to the Orange Bowl. I don't think we got a bump at all in enrollment,
which
I think we were all expecting.
Yeah, and I think that's often, people are often disappointed. I will say that's a bad memory for me because I was at Kent State at the time, who you beat us in the MAC championship. One of the greatest games I've seen. It was a fantastic game. But that was probably your moment. And other schools have had those moments and, again, tend to see. I remember TCU had a great football year one year, and the guy who was my enrollment management person was talking about he had talked with the guy from TCU who was all excited when he talked with him like in January, and he talked with him like later and it was like, yeah, we barely made our enrollment numbers at the end. It looked much better based on the applications early on. So if we go to the next slide, so the present, what are we dealing with right now? So the House decision, just was reached recently. And I think none of us in either our positions or in Sean's position are feeling like, oh good, everything's solved now, this is gonna get a lot better. In fact, the survey that they just did on presidents, 75% feel worse about the direction we're going in college athletics, and 86% are very worried about the finances. I will say ADs are 80% of ADs are worried, so this is not unique to those of us in the president's role. So what aspects are in there? One is, the new payroll where they can go up to $20.5 million in paying athletes directly. Again, that's not a requirement that you do it. If you're in the Power Four, you're almost certainly doing it. Most others are somewhere less than that, although it varies from institution to institution of what they're doing. For most that I can read, and again, most have been very secretive about what they're doing, but if you can judge anything by what they are honestly or saying they're honestly doing, 75% of that's going to football, 15% to men's basketball, 5% to women's basketball, and 5% to the rest. That's the equation I see most of them that have talked publicly about it. So it's overwhelmingly towards male sports, which I'll get back to later, but that's kind of where they are. That is where we are today. That will escalate over the years going forward, or at least it's anticipated to. There was the issue of the back pay. Again, the House decision was coming from former athletes who say, you kept me from making the money I could have made. And so the NCAA now has a back pay issue that all of us are paying into to some degree. I know for us it's about $500,000 a year less that we'll get from the NCAA in distribution. So, but that varies across them. There also is roster size limits. This has an impact in a few ways. Traditionally you didn't have a limit on roster size, and that was a concern for some schools because they were over on those rosters. They had more swimmers or whatever the sport was than the roster size would allow. I will say that was relatively common, more so in women's sports, where they were trying to meet Title IX expectations, and so they would have very large softball teams and track teams, much larger than the men, so that the numbers kind of made them to where they were close to proportionality, which was what they were trying to do. So anyway, so they don't have that option anymore. We have a limit. But also the scholarship limits went up. For most sports, they were what were called equivalency sports, where you say have 9.9 equivalent scholarships that you could spread out among all of those athletes. You don't have to do that. If it's like my sport of wrestling, you now can give out, you have a roster limit of 30, you can give out 30 scholarships. So that's different than it was before. And I'll come back to that issue too. And then we also have the College Sports Commission, NIL Go. This happens so quickly that they're now trying to put together a system that will both evaluate, are you staying within your essentially salary cap with athletes, as well as do these things actually make sense, these NIL agreements? In other words, if I'm doing a deal with a car dealership, is this just a way to pay me a whole lot of extra money that has limited value for that car dealership, or is this a fair exchange? And so they are evaluating all of those NIL deals to see whether they're fair or not. This is happening, again, at a rapid pace, and they are struggling to keep up with all of it. Not surprising. Again, they had to put this together very, very fast. There is also a cost to that system, which we are also going to be paying into to pay for the cost of that kind of oversight. So what do I see coming in the future? And that's the next slide. We're probably not done with lawsuits. The NCAA is, I think, more aware than they ever were before. I will say, my own view, for much of its history, the NCAA had a level of arrogance about its ability to win lawsuits that was detrimental in the long run, because they could have made changes, I think, 10, 20 years ago that would have avoided much of the mess we have today, but were so confident in their ability to win that they held on to a system that was legally indefensible for far too long. And those who had me in class 20 years ago know I said that 20 years ago, that they needed to give on this a lot quicker. Now that I think they're much more aware, I will say Charlie Baker, I think I just heard him speak about the allowing for betting and gambling was a calculation that they were going to lose that lawsuit, and I get that. So he was making a decision based on that, which I think, again, is a more rational thing than I saw the NCAA doing for a long period of time. But we're probably not done. There continues to be lawsuits from those not covered by the back pay. They're still trying to come after that. We see there's a whole issue of the Title IX and the salaries. If we're putting most of that money, 90% plus to men's sports, is that really fair and equitable under Title IX? I think there's certainly questions there. So again, I think there's a lot to still play out from a legal standpoint. There's also legislation at the federal level, the SCORE and SAVE Act, and a number of other suggestions, one of which was really interesting. I think I just read this recently. It was one of the congressmen was suggesting legislation that would cap coaches' salaries. I think it was 10 times the tuition at that institution, which would not affect some of us nearly as much as it would affect some others. It would affect in a pretty significant way. But again, that was kind of an interesting one. So again, there's a lot of things going on, but as anyone who's watching Washington knows right now, it is incredibly difficult for them to come to agreement on anything. And something as complicated as this, I'm not holding my breath thinking that the legislation will solve all of this. And they have clear differences on what they believe is important. Republicans tend to be, I think, much more on the side of looking at how do we keep players from making too much, how do we keep kind of control with the universities in contrast to the players, and Democrats tend to be on the opposite side of that. So there's this clear kind of fundamental difference on that I don't see going away very quickly. So they may find some things that they can do, but I don't know whether that's going to happen or not. I think we're still waiting to see what the Power Four may ultimately do. There's lots of discussion that do they just break away completely from the rest of us? I think that that's a distinct possibility. Or at least break away from the rest of us in football. That's the one I think is maybe even more likely. I can make an argument that the NCAA March Madness benefits from having a lot of schools across Division I in it. It's a lot harder argument to make in football. I think they would like to have all 12 spots. They've given one spot to somebody outside the Power Four. I'm not sure they're all thrilled with that. So I think that still remains to be played out a little bit. And what does that look like? Is it just football? Is it every sport? I was talking with an FCS AD the other day who actually said that they were surprised that this hasn't happened already. They're kind of almost anticipating that this could come. Again, it may not, but I think it's something we're all looking at. Moving up or moving down, what is interesting to me is we continue to see schools talk about moving up. So going from, say, Division II to Division I or even Division III to Division I, based on the fiscal model I just talked about, that seems to be not a rational economic decision to make, but yet institutions are still continuing to do that. And full disclosure, SIUE did that about 15 years ago. And many people still think it's the greatest decision we've ever made. So that tends to be the much more popular decision, moving from 2 to 1. Moving down, which would seem to make great fiscal sense, almost never happens. And it's so rare that I can't analyze it because there's not enough in my sample to make any real generalization about is that a good thing or a bad thing. From a purely fiscal standpoint, it looks like a smart move, and there are a couple schools recently that have done it. I think one of the concerns is, well, that enrollment will go down. I can say for at least those schools, they did about as well as you would expect them to do. It did not seem to have an impact on enrollment. But those are a couple schools that are very unique and not at all like mine and not like yours. So I don't know what that would mean for any of the rest of us to make that kind of move. And I will say, most are not even talking about that as a decision. What I do hear people talking much more about is essentially, I'll call it a Division III model at the Division I level, which is for many sports that they basically become non-scholarship sports, that whether that's swimming or other sports, we say, hey, you can get an academic scholarship, but we're not offering athletic scholarships. And I've heard that not just from those of us at the FCS or Group of Five level, I've heard that from Power Four schools as well, of that's where we see this going. We just don't see this as a good model. And frankly, many of them, and I'll take swimming, not to pick on swimming, but many of them are outstanding students. I've had a lot of them in class. They will qualify for academic scholarships. They also come from more affluent families. It's not a poor person's sport. They're probably going to be okay financially if we were to do that model, and then they still can compete at the Division I level as opposed to eliminating the program completely. So I do think we'll see kind of more of that. There is a lot of discussion about why that's bad, in part because, well, we need to support our Olympic movement by having all of these sports and having these scholarships and all of those things. I will give you my own perspective on that. If we were going to use the model we've developed to create Olympic athletes is the most inefficient model we could ever possibly come up with, of having all of us have all of these programs so we can produce two people in the freestyle, 100 meter freestyle. That is not a very efficient model for creating Olympic athletes. And I will say too, it's kind of funny, no one has brought this up, but they seem to ignore that international student athletes come here as well to prepare for the Olympics. I remember watching a swimming final once, and every single one of them went to an American university. So we're not only producing our own Olympic athletes, we're producing everybody else's too. So I'm not sure that's the strong argument for not making some changes there. I think what is interesting, and this has been talked about, is there's opportunities for success in certain sports. So let's just take my sport of wrestling. And actually, there's institutions that have done that. My father played college sports. He was a college football player at Clarion and was briefly on their first wrestling team back in 1959, 1960. What Clarion decided in the 1960s is we can't compete in football, men's basketball, but we can pick one men's and one women's sport to be really competitive at. And they picked wrestling and women's gymnastics and invested in those sports. And by the 1970s, Clarion actually one year had three of the 10 national champs in wrestling were from Clarion. They were able to compete at the highest level because they focused on that, and women's gymnastics was also extraordinarily successful for them. They've kind of moved away from that. But given what we have now, where you could spend $20.5 million on your wrestling program and give 30 scholarships out, there's a school that could create a great program in one of those sports because they decided to go all in on that. Whether anybody will do that or not, I don't know, but they may do it partially. You know, not as extreme as I just talked about, but at least investing maybe in a baseball program at a much higher level than the Power Four is able to do because of their emphasis on football and men's basketball, that I can certainly see happening. So I think we'll see some of that. And this is in contrast to, I think, what has happened a lot, and I'll give you, well, a lot of times what in most places I've been, it's like, all right, we have to focus on football and men's basketball because they get the most attention, and so we're going to go all in on that. When I was in the Big South, where we didn't have a football program at Winthrop, the conference decided right before I got there, we were going all in on men's and women's basketball. Those were going to be our sports. We were going to way overspend. We were going to do everything was on that. At one point, they even tried to determine what our budget should be for those sports, which I pushed back on. I was like, I should decide what the budget should be, not you. But that was, but we were going to go all in on those two sports. That was a decade ago. Since that time, the Big South has won only three games ever in the NCAA tournament in men's and women's basketball. All of those were 16 seed play-in games, which if you're the 16th seed, that means you really haven't had a particularly good season. They have not won a single game in the round of 64 in men's or women's basketball at all, and have lost by double digits every single time. They have never lost by less than 10 points. Most of the losses in the 30-point range. So this idea of we're going to go all in on men's basketball, and that's going to distinguish us, is an extraordinarily failed model. And the Big South is probably a great example of that. So final thing, I think as an institution, what we talk about, and I think everybody talks about is, you know, what are our goals relative to athletics and what is a realistic goal? Clearly the Big South's goal of being a basketball powerhouse wasn't a realistic one. What realistically can we do? What are our goals? And how can we better take advantage of athletics to actually support some of those other goals? And I'll give you just an example of one of the things we've been doing under Chancellor Lane's leadership at Carbondale is they've done what they call the Saluki takeovers, where we go into communities, we visit every high school, we meet with donors, and we usually attach or often attach it to an athletic event. So when we played Purdue, we went to Indianapolis, then up to West Lafayette, did those types of events there. He's down in Texas right now doing that. We did it, we'll do it in Memphis coming up in a couple weeks. So kind of trying to say, well, maybe there is a way to help athletics help with enrollment and fundraising if we really are much more conscious about what we do. And so I think there we'll see more people thinking about that. And making sure when we have an athletic program that it is doing that kind of social things that we want, that students are coming to games. We are creating that atmosphere on campus that makes it where students feel a sense of belonging and they want to stay. So it's helping, maybe not with recruiting, but retention of students. And how are there things we can do on that? I'll give you one we did when I was at Winthrop, and then answer any other questions you have. But we had an issue with, we didn't get a lot of students coming to basketball games, even though that was our elite sport. And I was meeting with one of my board members, and she had an idea that I didn't think that the coach would even really like, but it got triggered another idea in my head. And I said, what if I can get a bunch of donors to give $100 every time we win a men's or women's basketball game, and we give scholarship to students who are at the game? So you have to be there to get the scholarship. And it was, so we gave out three $500 scholarships at every game, only if we won. So that was the key. We had to win, and you had to be there at the end of the game to get the scholarship, so you can't leave early. Pretty soon, we had our student section packed, and no one left the game. When we sang the alma mater at the end of the game, you could hear it. It was loud in that facility. It changed the entire atmosphere, and what it actually helped us do was get the community to come back because it was fun to be there again because the students were kind of bringing that enthusiasm to the game. We ended up not keeping with it for the long term, partly because once we got it going, we didn't need to keep doing that program, and we wanted our donors to give to other things. So we changed over time, but initially it got us over that hump of we don't have the student presence at games that we wanted. But it was a creative way of trying to do it differently. And again, was pretty effective. I had a basketball coach at the time, Pat Kelsey, who's now at the University of Louisville, who, if you've ever met Pat, he is 100 miles an hour all the time. And he would do the whole scholarship give out at the end of the game, which was, he took it to another level of excitement. So again, taking advantage of some of the things we had as resources, and Pat was one of those resources. So happy to answer any other questions you have.
Thank you. That was great, and thank you for all the data. So the collectives,
yeah,
that have been put in place by most of the all of the Power Fours and even, you know, a lot of the Group of Six, they're still in place even with the payout now going on of the $20.5 million.
Mm-hmm. Some are and some aren't. So some have tried to move away from the collective. Some have kept the collective. So it's been a little bit varied on how they've done those. But again, a number of them still have them. That is correct.
Well, because that was going to be my question. So Deloitte is running the GO program.
Right.
So, I mean, I kind of look at the NIL payments are coming from the local car dealer, as you mentioned, which are legitimate. But then a lot of the NIL payments are coming from alumni through the collective. Do those go through Deloitte, and does Deloitte approve those, or is that something that Deloitte's not even looking at?
I think, Sean, I would imagine they still have to go through technically, yeah. I think if it's anything beyond the $20.5 million, they would have to be evaluated but through that process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so then my no, please, Sean. So then my question, Coach, is, is there a limit, and who's making the decision on the NIL money that's coming from the collective on how much an athlete gets?
Yeah, so again, I know more about it at before the House decision because the guy who runs the NIL collective at the University of Louisville used to be one of my students, so I had him in class talking about it. So I know what they were doing at the time. And they were kind of acting as, in some ways, like the general manager role that we're seeing more and more schools have now, where they were kind of deciding, working with the coaches closely on how much they were going to give to each of the athletes in order to build a roster, which is how, I mean, Louisville went from being a really bad basketball team a couple years ago to making the NCAA tournament in 1 year. That roster was built entirely from scratch and using the collective as a major part of that. So I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. Dr. Mahoney, yeah. So they being the College Sports Commission, which is this new entity, which is in collaboration with the NCAA, has put significant rules and regulations around collectives, NIL, NIL goal, cap system, what's financed through the university, what's external. So there's a laundry list. I just put a communication out to our Husky Nation to take a look at these particular areas and how the flow chart goes on and who is responsible for that. So there's all regulations. NIL, the collectors themselves have to go through that process and has to be an approval of that. And that structure right now is being reviewed and it's been hung up to the tune of several million right now. So there's a process of accountability that's in place, that's in concert with the NCAA. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, and I do think this is another building the plane as you're flying it type of thing. So I think a lot of it we're still trying to figure out as they go through it. So the guest speaker I had last spring, I'll have again next year, and it may be a different presentation and how they're managing through it, but they're trying to figure that out.
Well, I mean, it's crazy because I know some of the collectives, I mean, I'm not in the boardroom, but I have read, you know, some of the collectives at the bigger Power Four schools were $25-30 million, and now you add on top of that the $20.5 million. Man alive, I mean, the money that's going to the athletes right now just can be incredible.
And I did not get into which I think is most people's biggest concern is the transfer portal, which I didn't get into, but it's not unrelated to the fact that if you have, for example, $45 million to build a team, you can pick off players from other schools fairly easily who don't have anywhere near that, and we certainly don't at either of the SIU schools.
And then the players, just so.
Trustee Appice.
Sorry. The players can still do an NIL agreement on their own, right?
It still has to be reviewed at this point.
It still has to be reviewed,
yeah.
But it's not part of the overall $20 million.
No, the $20 million is pure salary at this point. The $20.5 million is salary. They don't have to be doing things at a car dealership or anything like that to get that. That's separate from the endorsement deals and things like that, which they also can do, which again, a lot of them are doing. There's so many different ways to monetize mm-hmm. name now. You know, our chancellor at Carbondale, Chancellor Lane, his son played at Texas A&M and Georgia mm-hmm. Tech, so he was experiencing it kind of firsthand, and he was doing everything from going to the local sandwich shop and posting that he was there at certain times. He was doing all kinds of things. He was a go-getter and got and accumulated a lot of money. A very good player. He was a starting wide receiver for them, but not like the star of that team either. But he mm-hmm. earned a good amount of money doing that, and that was a couple years ago, you know, before it was the salary, before all of these other things.
Trustee Strom.
I'm curious. I mean, the impact on conference realignments, too, mm-hmm. in the last several years. And where are we in that process? I mean, are we still early stage, we mid stage, we late stage? Obviously, we've been impacted mm-hmm. because of the Big Ten, Pac-12, yeah. Mountain West, all of the realignments. I mean, is there still more to come on that? I mean, and even the survivability of some of the conferences.
I would say I think there's still more to come. Personally, that's just my guess. I don't think we're anywhere close to done as everybody tries to figure out what's in their best financially, what's best for them financially, what's best for them from a PR standpoint, what's best for them. Again, even if I'm using it more for student recruitment, it doesn't make more sense for me to have games in places where I can actively recruit, and that may mean a different conference. So I think everybody's trying to play all that out. So yeah, I think we'll continue to see a lot of that. That was actually one of my favorite moments when the Big Ten and the SEC really expanded. And one of my former students said that I said that in class 20 years ago, that was coming. And I was just thrilled a student remember what I said in class 20 years ago. I'm happy when they remember what I said last week, but the fact they remember what I said 20 years ago. But I think there's some who feel like we may get to a point where there really is a power two and not a power four. I think that's another possibility. And whether that means them scooping up a few more schools and then pushing the rest down, I think that's still a distinct possibility.
Trustee Wasowitz.
By the way, thanks. This was an incredibly informative discussion and answers, you know, a lot of questions, but also brings up a lot more. And this is an unsustainable model. You've laid out all the financials. And so as a mid-major, whether it's SIU Edwardsville or, mm-hmm. or it's NIU, where does all this go? Does it become the haves and the have-nots? Does it go back to the students running things because they want to play athletics? Does it go back to that? I mean, where do you see all this heading? Because it can't yeah. continue.
And this is the thing I've been thinking about, to be honest, a lot, both for my role as a president, again, just as someone who studies it. I don't disagree. In my mind, the path we're on is not sustainable for most of us. I always say college athletics, you know, if you go back to the 1980s when states were heavily investing in universities, enrollment was going up, the finances to support it was there. And so even if it lost some money, and it wasn't losing nearly as much back then, but even if it lost some money, it was not a unsustainable thing. That, and in fact, one of my jokes always is when people ask me what's my dream job, where I want to be president, I said 1985. It was an entirely different environment for university presidents then, and much more manageable, and athletics was frankly much more manageable. That's not true. None of those things are true now. We have financial issues in almost every university that are significant and massive, and you add this one on, I don't see how it's sustained. My biggest concern right now is no one is having the discussion about what would it look like if it was entirely different, if we're not held to what we currently have. So, for example, at the Division I level, we've got, you know, a requirement of 14 or 16 programs, depending on where you are in that Division I level. What if I only want 6? Why is that not okay? If that's what I feel like can sustain and I can provide a high-quality experience for students in 6 programs, why are you forcing me to have 16? Just so I'm part of the Division I. That doesn't make any sense. We have a lot of rules in place that are based on an old model. But actually in my class, one of the things my students do in their group project is I tell them that take everything you know about college athletics, throw it out the window, start from scratch. And that's actually some of the models they've come up with is you don't have to have as many sports and you can do this differently and you're much more regional in your conferences. And maybe if you break out football and do football separate and everything else is very regional. There's lots of things like that that could be done, but I don't see anything in the federal legislation or the discussion at the NCAA that is looking at a more radical transformation, which is, I think, what we need.
Okay, so there's going to be a lot of change.
I think there's going to continue to be change. I'm hopeful that at some point we get to a discussion of what if we aren't held to, this is the way it's always been and it has to be that way going forward. Are there some different ways we can think about it? Even if we're going to go division, kind of go to a Division III model, say, and pick a sport like swimming, why don't we compete at the Division III level in swimming and the Division I level of basketball like we do it based on what our investment is in that particular sport? That's a very radical and different change, but I don't hear anybody other than me talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, athletics is table stakes for a university. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to have it, especially right. Someone like you've been or I've been right. As well. One other question.
And I will say, too, that's part of the thing I think that, you know, I was reading something someone wrote from a Division III level that those at the Division I, the bigger schools, could probably get away with not having athletics. It was like, I don't think a single person believes that that's the case. And so, yeah, it was nice that they thought that, but I don't think any of us think that.
Yeah, there's a guy at Eastern Michigan, I think, thinks that, and that's about
That's
about it. The you mentioned before about Kent State and NIU.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the 2012 game?
Yeah, I believe that was 2012, yeah.
Is that
yeah.
the one that went into two overtimes?
Yes.
And is that the one that NIU ended up winning?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Thank you for that commercial, too.
I believe the final score was 44-37, cool. But, yeah. You know.
Well, I will tell you, the funny thing on that was we actually had the sport management program had its reverse for raffle, which was their fundraiser, scheduled on that night. And I went to someone and said, why in the world did you schedule on the night of the MAC championship? And he says, who in the world thought at the beginning of the season we had any chance of being in the MAC championship? And that was just a weird year for Kent State. It was the best year we had in a long, long time. And both for NIU and Kent State, they were really fabulous teams in a great year.
We came back.
Yeah.
One more question from Trustee Barsema.
No. Thank you. So my view is even within the Power Four, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. got separation occurring. As you mentioned, you know, the top 20, 25 are really, you know, doing something from a profitability and performance standpoint, and the rest aren't. But if you were in the role that you're in now at one of the Big Ten schools that's middle of the pack, and the football coach is making $6 million a year, how do you, as the president, what is the value of that coach to the university if they're finishing 12th in the Big Ten? What's the value? How do you, as the president of that university, justify to your board paying $6 million a year to the coach? Where does the coach earn that money?
Yeah, I'll say a couple things. One is I'll go back to the Jerry Reinsdorf quote, which is I'm paying him $6 million because everybody else is paying their coach $6 million, and that is my major justification. It's not that I've done any economic analysis and show that's worth it. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that's interesting. It's not, whenever I bring up coaches' salaries, people always say, well, what about Nick Saban and all he did for Alabama? It's like, there's one Nick Saban. There's a lot of other coaches that are getting paid enormous salaries who are not at that level. But even beyond that, you know, one of the things I looked at about a year or two ago was, you talk about the head coach, but all of the assistant coaches' salaries. And so I looked at my chancellors. It was one of the times we were getting hit, you know, how come your chancellors make so much money? And my chancellors would be either the sixth or seventh highest paid assistant coach on a football staff in the Big Ten. I think they're more valuable to the university than a linebacker's coach. Just my personal opinion, and the potential return on investment from fundraising and all of the things that a president and chancellor does is, to me, much more easy for me to justify fiscally than the decisions we make in football. On salaries and basketball, but again, it's a lot of it has to do with this is what everyone else is doing. It isn't because we really have found a way that this makes sense.
Well, and that's, and I agree with you 100% from the sustainability standpoint. I mean, the model that we have today, with the exception of maybe 25 schools in the country, I don't understand how it's going to be sustainable.
Yeah,
it's just. You add up the numbers, and at some point in time, somebody's going to say, we can't keep losing all this money.
Right. Yeah. Well, I will say the interesting thing that, again, from the one legislation, whether that's even close to realistic or not, but as much as people are focusing on the players' compensation, which is certainly a huge additional cost, The coaches' compensation, again, has long exceeded most places what is rational economically. But any attempts to control that nationally runs into antitrust laws. And so with the exception of federal legislation that would give us an antitrust exemption to control that, we're going to get hit. And in fact, just this week, the NCAA lost another case where they now have to do back pay for volunteer coaches because, again, violation of antitrust. They had the same thing. They had a limitation on the, I think it was the third assistant basketball coach back like in the 1990s. They lost that case and it was 50-some million that they lost on that. So we can't do it across the board without some type of federal intervention on that, which again, if there was gonna be federal intervention, that would be one of my choices.
Any other questions? First of all, thank you very much.
No, thank
very
you.
Insightful. Very insightful. I feel like we need to call your presentation Mythbusters because a lot of us believe that, well, totally opposite of what you were presenting, but thank you very much. Next item on our agenda is agenda item number 8, the next meeting date, excuse me, the next regularly scheduled meeting of the full Board of Trustees is December 11th, 2025 at 9 a.m.
Trustee Gales, actually, I don't know if we need to make an amendment to that since we have a special meeting scheduled for next week.
Our next regularly scheduled meeting is December 11th, okay. But we will have a special meeting on November 20th.
Okay, and what time will that start? At 9?
10 a.m.
At 10. The board needs to go into closed session. We do not plan to take up any new business following the closed session. May I have a motion to close the public meeting to conduct a closed session to discuss the following subjects authorized by the Illinois Open Meetings Act. Closed session matters as generally described under Section 2C21 of the Open Meetings Act. Collective bargaining matters as generally described under Section 2C2 of the Open Meetings Act. Litigation and risk management matters as generally described under Sections 2C11 and 12 of the Open Meetings Act. Personnel matters is generally described under Sections 2C1, 2, 3, and 21 of the Open Meetings Act. There's a period at the end of that. May I have a motion?
So moved, Athis.
Is there a second?
Second, Wasowitz.
Hearing that, Ms. Doyle, no. Crystal, will you please take a roll call vote to close the meeting?
Trustee Rita Athis?
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Barsima?
Yes.
Vice Chair John Butler?
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero?
Yes.
Trustee James Innes?
Yes.
Trustee Leland Strom?
Yes.
Trustee Eric Wasowitz?
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Yes. The meeting is now closed.